This recording was made by Louis Alexander on the 20th of February 1981. This is an off-the-cuff, impromptu attempt to survey some of the significant landmarks in the history of English language teaching in the 20th century. The first of these landmarks must surely be Harold Palmer's The Scientific Study and Teaching of Languages, which appeared in 1917. This was followed a few years later, in 1921, by The Principles of Language Study, which contained an insight which, consciously or not, was to affect language teaching and learning very profoundly at a later date. The insight was Palmer's observation, and I quote from memory, that whatever the unit of language may be, it is certainly not the word. Throughout the century, that is since about 1917, two clear impulses can be discerned. The first is the search for some kind of syllabus or framework, and the second is the search for some means of interpreting this syllabus to produce a suitable methodology. Palmer's insight about the unit of language was curiously ignored in the work that followed in the 30s, where the main concentration of effort was on words themselves, words regarded as units of language. And this led to word counts, and in particular to Thorndike and Log's A Semantic Count of English Words, which appeared in 1938. And which was later adapted as the General Service List by Michael West. The General Service List formed the first proper syllabus for ELT, and the main objective seemed to be to cover the 2,000 words as rapidly as possible, thus providing students with a high-frequency vocabulary, and, it was assumed by extension, a basic competence. Michael West's entire work in the 30s and 40s was devoted to words themselves, and in particular, his New Method readers attempted to cover the 2,000 words step by step to equip students with a minimum adequate vocabulary. It's worth quoting a snippet from the New Method readers because it illustrates very well just what West's approach was. In this particular quotation from the New Method Readers, Reader 3, published by Longmans in 1954, West is setting out to teach four words from the General Service List. The words are pleasure, service, seek, and the past of seek, sought. He contextualizes these words in a passage about bees. This is the passage. The bees are rich. The hive is like a very rich city, full of stores of riches and food. But the bees are not healthy, for the men bees spend lazy lives of pleasure without service. Yet there is no real pleasure to be had without service. Lazy people, who live only for themselves, are never really happy. So the men do not get real pleasure out of life, and in the end they meet a fearful death. The women bees spend lives of service without pleasure, and in the end they die of their work. Yet they work for nothing, for their work brings no pleasure to anyone or to themselves. Bee Town is a great and rich town, but it is a very unhappy town. The bee has riches, but it has not wisdom. The wise man seeks to live a happy life and to make others happy. We may seek happiness in work. We may seek happiness in rest. Happiness may be sought in riches. It may be sought in simple living. Happiness can be sought and found in all things, if we seek these things wisely, if we seek them not for themselves, but for the pleasure which they bring to others and to us. At the end of this rather sonorous passage, there's a black box in which, in bold type, we see, "You now know 893 words." What is interesting about that passage is that the emphasis is wholly on presenting the words themselves, with very little account taken of the difficulty of the structure. The structure is, in fact, very difficult indeed. Sentences like, "We may seek happiness in work, we may seek happiness in rest, happiness may be sought in riches, it may be sought in simple living," would be regarded as very advanced indeed in any modern language course. There's no attempt to simplify structure, but every attempt to simplify the words themselves. So there's a general avoidance of the technical vocabulary that would be necessary for this text. Thus, for example, we find reference to men bees instead of drones. We find references to women bees and bee town and so on. And there's a general avoidance of the technical terms themselves. The curious thing is, of course, that terms like women bees, men bees, and bee town don't even exist in the English language. In this approach, while students were acquiring the 2,000 words, they had to struggle with the very difficult structures in which these words were couched. Even so, we must recognize that the build-up was extremely systematic. The words were covered thoroughly, and a whole library of books in the shape of the New Method Supplementary Readers was born. And indeed, the whole concept of simplifying language according to vocabulary and of dividing language into stages has remained with us to this day. Though the method has long since been abandoned, the books are still widely used and read, and the general emphasis on vocabulary acquisition has remained with us to this day. At the same time Michael West was working on word counts and his New Method series, there was a curious dead-end development called Basic English, which produced some very interesting ideas, which, though developed to a certain extent, had a very limited life. Basic English was an invented language. Its inventor was C.K. Ogden, and it received a great deal of support from respected academics like I.A. Richards, who published in 1943 Basic English and Its Uses. It even received political support from Winston Churchill. Basic English is the first serious attempt to put English on the map as a world language. But to make it appear no more difficult than any of the invented languages, such as Esperanto, which some people were learning at the time. The essence of Basic English was that it had a vocabulary of about 800 words, and the entire syllabus could be printed on a single page. Indeed, it was frequently printed at the back of Basic English books. The 800 words were divided into several categories. There were operations, as they were called, which were verbs and prepositions and a few determiners and conjunctions. Then there were 400 things in alphabetical order, followed by 200 pictured things, and then 100 general qualities, that is, adjectives, with 50 opposites. There were very few verbs, only 16 in fact, and very few rules. For example, the addition of S to things when there's more than one. Endings in ER, ED, ING from 300 names of things. LY forms from qualities. Degree with more and most. Questions by change of order and do. Form changes in names and acts. And that, this, I, he, you, who, as in normal English. There were measures, numbers, days, months, and a few international words. So the whole syllabus was very neat indeed, and it looked very, very easy to acquire. In the late 40s and early 50s, this spawned a whole generation of materials which were used to a fairly limited extent, I would think. They didn't have a very long life, nor did they develop very much. Lockhart's basic teacher appeared in 1950, and this consisted of a methodology for this basic English syllabus. The methodology was a fairly familiar one, where each lesson began with a list of vocabulary, followed by a fairly long description of the structures that were to be learnt, and then followed by a reading text in basic English and some exercises. Basic English spawned a whole library of books, lots of simplified readers, classics like Pinocchio and so on, and many different methods, including The Basic Way to English, from which it is worth quoting an unintentionally amusing piece, which shows how the principle of implementing the syllabus through texts is applied. This is lesson 6 of The Basic Way to English, and it's called At the Table. There's a picture in the lesson showing two girls sitting at opposite ends of a table, and they're in curious positions, as you will be able to visualize when I read the text. Under one of the girls, there's a caption which reads, "That is you," and under the other girl, there's a caption which reads, "This is I." Here is the text. "Between my body and your body is a table. This is my seat, and that is your seat. The front of my body is opposite the table. My right leg is bent at the knee. My left hand is at the back of my head. In my right hand is a pencil. The pencil is between my finger and my thumb. Your neck is bent. A part of your left arm is on the table. Your chin is on your left hand. A bent finger of your hand is in your mouth, and a straight finger is at the side of your nose. A toe of your right foot is on the seat. On this side of your head is an ear, and on this side of your face is an eye. Your left ear is on the opposite side, and your left eye is on the opposite side. Your right hand is off the table. On the table is a box. I put my pencil in your hand. You take the pencil." I think even the inventors of basic English had in the end to admit that it was a failure, because soon after the whole basic English system was published, they found it necessary to publish another set of 6 books called From Basic to Wider English, so that students who had learnt basic English could come to terms with ordinary English. Book 1 of this course, which I'm looking at this moment, is concerned with the letters of a Mrs. C.M. Nesbitt, a fictitious character who writes letters beginning "Dear Reader" and attempts to describe life in Britain. The first letter is entitled My House and Family. It consists of a long text, and all the new vocabulary, i.e. vocabulary which is not included in the basic English syllabus, is printed in bold. And then this text, which is quite long, it runs on for a couple of pages, is followed by very detailed notes on the new vocabulary, and that is followed by exercises. The second letter is called Getting Up and Going to Work. The third letter is called Getting the Week's Food. The fourth letter is called Sunday and Sunday Dinner. It provides a very quaint and interesting period study of life in Britain in the late 40s and early 50s, with rather stereotyped pictures. Basic English was doomed to fail for 2 very simple reasons. Obvious to us now, but not so obvious then. The first reason, I think, was that it didn't allow the student to cope with ordinary English, so all his efforts were doomed from the start. He could only communicate with other learners of basic. English, after all, isn't an artificial language like Esperanto, so it was a false assumption to assume that you could treat it as such. And the second reason why it failed was, I think, that it was a bit of a cheat, really, because in order to be able to express everything in basic English, which indeed you could just about, after all, the Bible was translated into basic and many Shakespeare plays, the only way you could do this was by cheating, that is, by utilizing to an absolute maximum the potential of phrasal verbs, so that your very few verbs, get, put, keep, take, and so on, were used with particles to present the reader with very difficult phrasal verbs like put up with, and so on, which were not really counted when it came to analyzing the range of vocabulary items covered. In other words, basic English was just too idiomatic for the foreign learner. As a system, it had a very short life, but we can only admire it for its ingenuity and simplicity, and there's a great deal to be learnt from it, particularly the extremely simple syllabus, which can be printed on a single page. It would certainly be an achievement these days to devise a grammatical or other description of language which is simple enough to fit onto one page. In some ways, it was quite sophisticated in its presentation. For example, it's the first course I've ever seen with an interleaved teacher's book, and that prompted me to devise a similar layout when I came on to designing First Things First. Basic English simply faded away. Michael West was still going strong in the 50s, and round about the mid-50s, two important figures appeared on the scene. A.S. Hornby was one of them, and Eckersley was the other. Eckersley's brighter English, followed by his essential English, achieved very great success indeed, as did Hornby's Oxford Progressive English for adult learners. Eckersley's success was largely due to the appeal of his storyline. Mr. Priestley, the protagonist of Essential English, was a very popular character indeed. Eckersley's method was quite straightforward. He took little account of the work that Michael West had been doing. He presented language in the form of grammatical paradigms, followed by fairly long texts about the doings of Mr. Priestley. There was no attempt to control vocabulary a la West, or to integrate structure and vocabulary. By comparison, Hornby's work was based on a much more rigorous and scientific view of language, which can be found in two very important books. The first of these is A Guide to Patterns and Usage in English, which was first published in 1954, and the second was The Teaching of Structural Words and Sentence Patterns, which was published in 1959. These two books pointed the way to the future and really took their cue from the observation made by Harold Palmer in 1921 that whatever the unit of language might be, it is certainly not the word. Though these books contained many profound insights into the nature of English, the courses in which the principles were applied, particularly the progressive English course for adult learners, didn't differ very much from Eckersley's approach. Again, there were grammatical paradigms, box sets of items, and texts. Here's a typical text from Hornby's progressive English course. Look at this picture. There is a man in this picture. What is he doing? He is carrying a tray. What is there on the tray? There are two bottles on the tray. They are bottles of beer. There are two glasses on the tray. Look at the second picture. There are two men in this picture. What are they doing? They are sitting at a table. Is it a square table? No, it is not a square table. It is a round table. What is there on the table? There are two bottles. The men are drinking beer. Look at the third picture. There is a woman in this picture. She is going into a shop. It is a hat shop. There are some hats in the shop window. The woman is opening the shop door. She is going into the shop. How many hats are there in the shop window? There are three. How many women are there in this picture? There is only one woman in this picture. What we have in these texts is the first notion of grading, of attempting to present language in some order of increasing difficulty. The first attempt to give academic credibility to this approach was contained in the Linguistic Sciences and Language Teaching by Halliday, McIntosh and Strevens, which was published in 1964. In this work, a distinction is drawn between open sets, that is, lexical items which don't have any grammatical significance, and closed systems, that is, structural words. Harold Palmer's views were implemented at last, and structural grading, as we would understand it today, had been born. The courses which appeared from the mid-60s to the present time, and there have been a great many, have been largely based on the idea of structural grading, in which an attempt is made to teach grammatical structures in order of increasing difficulty, and combining these structures with high-frequency lexical items. The method has been one of what I can only describe now as situationalized structure. Structures are presented in a sequence. They are put into a context, and exercises are then based on the text, which may be presented audiovisually or audiolingually. Here's a quotation from a text from First Things First, from New Concept English, which was published in 1967, and which took up the idea of structural grading in a fairly thoroughgoing fashion. This particular text contextualizes the structures must be and can't be to indicate deduction. The scene is a restaurant. Can you recognize that woman, Millie? I think I can, Kate. It must be Karen Marsh, the actress. I thought so. Who's that beside her? That must be Conrad Reeves. Conrad Reeves, the actor? It can't be. Let me have another look. I think you're right. Isn't he her third husband? No, he must be her fourth or fifth. Doesn't Karen Marsh look old? She does, doesn't she? I read she's 29, but she must be at least 40. I'm sure she is. She was a famous actress when I was still a schoolgirl. That was a long time ago, wasn't it? Not that long ago. I'm not more than 29 myself. Here we have an attempt to present structures in a fairly light-hearted way through simply written texts, very often with a simple payoff at the end. And these texts are then used as a basis for language study. And though vocabulary is very strictly controlled, if a technical term has to be used, it is used without any hesitation. The idea being that it is important to master the structure rather than worry about the difficulty of an individual item. After all, any situation can require items that are way outside the general service list, so there are times when the general service list has to be completely ignored. Structural grading, as a view of language teaching, finds its ultimate expression in English grammatical structure, which was published by Longman in 1975, and in which there's a serious attempt to grade English in terms of six stages and to provide a commentary on the graded structures. Virtually all the major courses that have appeared since the mid-1960s make use of structural grading, and even today it is by far the most popular approach to language teaching and learning. However, in the early 70s we saw a move which was to make us rethink our view of structural grading, and this really has its origins in the work of the Council of Europe. It is as if our collective consciousness was suddenly awakened, and instead of creating materials which are based on nothing more than changing fashions, arbitrary examination syllabuses, and market forces, we paused to ask ourselves what exactly it was that we were trying to achieve. In 1971, a symposium sponsored by the Council for Cultural Cooperation of the Council of Europe was held at Rüschlikon. The expressed aim was, and I quote, to examine the possibility of organizing modern language teaching and learning in the form of a unit credit system in order to allow an approach based on the individual motivation and capacities of the adult learner. From this beginning, the Council of Europe Modern Languages Project, under the direction of John Trim, was launched. This led to the setting up of working parties and the publication of influential and thought-provoking papers on many aspects of foreign language acquisition. These were first published separately, then collected in a single volume entitled Systems Development in Adult Language Learning, published by the Council of Europe in 1973. These papers were followed by the development and publication of sets of specifications which can only be described as proto-syllabuses for the teaching of the major European languages. These were the Threshold Level by Van Eck in 1975, followed by a more modest objective defined as Way Stage in 1977 for the teaching of English as a foreign language. Then there was Un Niveau Seuil by Cost and others in 1976 for the teaching of French. Then there were specifications for the teaching of German, Kontaktschwelle, published in 1980, and Un Nivel Umbral for the teaching of Spanish, also in 1980, with Livello Soglia for Italian still to come. All these specifications must be regarded as proto-syllabuses from which specific syllabuses can be derived when we are designing courses, planning curricula, devising tests and examinations, and so on. All these specifications have a common aim. They attempt to define objectives in terms of the presumed communication needs of the learner. Their starting point is what the learner wants to do through language. As Van Eck says in the introduction to Way Stage, the basic characteristic of the model is that it tries to specify foreign language ability as a skill rather than knowledge. It analyzes what the learner will have to be able to do in the foreign language and determines only in the second place what language forms, words, structures, etc., the learner will have to be able to handle in order to do all that has been specified. This whole approach to course design has become widely known as the functional notional approach. In a structural approach, the attempt was simply to combine two inventories, as we have already seen. One inventory of structures and the other of vocabulary, in order to produce what I defined earlier as situationalized structure. Communication was merely the byproduct of this undertaking. In a functional notional approach, the attempt is to teach communication with structure and vocabulary, though they may be carefully graded, as a byproduct of this objective. If we are setting out to teach people to communicate, it follows that we have to encompass the principal factors involved, when we communicate. We have to ask ourselves what happens when we communicate. Functional notional syllabuses are really syllabuses which attempt to encode what might be going on when we communicate. They consist of inventories and descriptions of a number of things that can happen. For example, functions. That is, language acts like agreeing, refusing, offering, and so on, are always behind whatever we are trying to do when we are communicating with other people. General notions, that is, abstract time and space relations which connect with functions, general notions like existence, non-existence, presence, absence, mobility, immobility, are also present, as are specific notions, that is, items which are directly determined by the topic. So, if we have a simple utterance, a question like, is there a bank near here, that can be regarded as an exponent of inquiring, which is the function, about the existence, which is the general notion, of a bank, which is the specific notion. Other things that occur when we are communicating are the importance or non-importance of the setting in which communication is taking place. Sometimes the setting can be so important that it actually influences the choice of items, as for example when we are buying tickets at a railway station, or it may simply serve as a background to communication. We also have to take into account the social, sexual, and psychological roles of the speakers, their social status, whether they are friends, acquaintances, or strangers, whether they are male or female, and their psychological attitudes at the time they're talking, whether they're hostile or friendly or neutral, and so on. We also have to take into account style and register, because expression can range between formal and informal, serious and jocular, courteous and rude, positive and tentative, and so on. Stress and intonation are also very important because they convey attitude and emotion and therefore are an essential part of communication. Grammar and vocabulary, which were the be-all and end-all of structural courses, are seen to be the means through which we express ourselves and not the sole factors. And finally, there are paralinguistic features in communication, gesture and facial expressions, which haven't been satisfactorily coded for language learning purposes. So a functional notional syllabus is a far more complicated affair than a structural syllabus, consisting of a great many inventories, not simply two, and therefore it is much more difficult to process a functional notional syllabus than a structural one. We're still at the beginning of this view of language, and it promises to be very exciting. The limitations of conventional course designs and methods have already become fairly clear. For example, grading in order of presumed difficulty is often fairly arbitrary. The division of the four skills into compartments, listening and understanding, speaking, reading and writing, is merely convenient for audiovisual presentation. While we are aware of these weaknesses, it is still too early to see some of the major weaknesses of a functional notional approach. I think it will take us at least a decade to assimilate this approach and to begin to understand its strengths and weaknesses. I would reckon that there are four major possible course designs that can be based on a functional notional approach. The first is a purely functional organization, where we set out to teach students slot and filler utterances, and I think that this approach could only be useful when designing phrase books. I'm thinking of phrase books where we teach students to inquire about availability, for example, using I've got or I haven't got, or we're teaching them to make requests, for example, I'd like a, or teaching them to talk about location, where's the nearest bank, please, and so on. This slot and filler approach to language study has already been applied in the Survive series, which is a redefinition of the phrase book. So a purely functional organization, teaching people to do things while disregarding the grammatical paradigms, has a very limited but interesting application in the field of phrase books, which haven't changed essentially since the 19th century. A second form of organization, which I think is already being looked at, is what I would define as a structural functional organization. That is, where we attempt to give the structural syllabus, but with a functional connotation. So we take the structural syllabus, or the structural order of difficulty, and instead of teaching expressions like, this is my nose, or this is the door, and that is the window, we teach, is this, this is, for introducing people to each other. And instead of teaching, what's this, what's that, with objects in the classroom, we teach it in a meaningful way. For example, to identify the names of things in a foreign language, or identify things we can't recognize, say in a self-service restaurant, or identify something we can't recall, say when we're listening to a piece of music. What's that? It's Beethoven's Fifth, and so on. The Communicative Grammar of English by Leach and Svartvik contains a lot of interesting insights into the communicative value of structures. I think, however, this structural functional approach might be doomed by the way in which the structural sequencing constantly asserts itself, so that in the end, what we have is merely a crypto-structuralist approach. A third possible form of organization you could define is a functional structural one, where you can take a function, such as apologizing, and attempt to examine all the structures that could be used to exemplify the act of apologizing. So, for example, if we teach apologizing, we might teach I'm sorry as a phrase, and then teach I'm sorry to, I'm sorry to have, I'm sorry for ing, I'm sorry for having, and so on. I think this approach is suitable for organizing materials at an intermediate level, and not at a beginner's level, because it throws up far too many structures to make sense at the beginner's level. A fourth approach, and to my mind the most interesting one, is the organization of the language corpus into what I call thematic areas. These are broad categories like location, description, likes, dislikes, wants, and so on. Thematic areas shouldn't be confused with centers of interest, like shopping, the garage, the bank, and so on. They're altogether much broader. And what we attempt to do here is to teach students to cope, say, with describing, or finding the way, or what have you. This form of organization is concerned with process. The approach has already been implemented in a number of materials. For example, Martin Bates's Nucleus, a course for science, Alan MacLean's Gateway, a new course for the Arab world, Jupp's Encounters, and my own Mainline Beginners, and also the multimedia series Follow Me. It's still too early to say how successful this type of course design has been, and it will be very interesting to see what developments there will be throughout this decade. But from a methodological point of view, I think we can already see fairly significant shifts. The audiovisual and audiolingual approaches are what I would now regard as blanket methodology. That is, they are text-based, repetitive, consisting largely of presenting texts and then exploiting them. I think one of the effects of a functional notional approach to course design will be, for example, a redefinition of the four skills. We don't see them in compartments, but think of the listening skill, say, as listen and assimilate, listen and take notes, listen and report, listen and interpret, and so on. So that we see language as consisting of various language activities, each activity requiring its own method. Looking something up in a telephone directory requires a different method from, say, taking part in a dialogue. So we're likely to see the resurgence of very many different methods to teach the different language activities which we can define. We're likely to redefine the nature of conversation, to distinguish between transactions, which are broadly predictable, like ordering a meal at a restaurant, and interactions, which can be the non-contentious exchange of information or discussion and argument. We're likely to see greater emphasis placed on the distinction between receptive and productive skills, so that students may be presented with authentic materials so they can discard redundant information from a very early level. We're likely to see very great emphasis placed on improvisation or transfer, where students are asked to cope with real-life situations. We're likely to see much more relevant situations, so that there's less emphasis on L1 to L1 situations. For example, you are asking your bank manager for a loan, which a student would do in his own language, and much more emphasis on the kind of language you would use in your own country as opposed to the kind of English you would use if you had to travel abroad. Grammar, I think, will become more traditional. Paradigms will be presented in a fairly conventional way, simply because it is impossible to drill every aspect of a grammatical paradigm. The verb be would take too long to drill, and of course we can only drill a part of it, then ask students to look at the paradigm and study the rest of it. I think students need to be made aware of what they are learning and why, so we're likely to see more signposting. We're likely to learn a good deal more than we know at the moment about pacing, how much material can reasonably be covered in a lesson. We're likely to redefine testing so that the techniques that are used to test a language are not conflated with the methods used to teach it. Perhaps we'll place less emphasis on grammatical correctness and attempt to develop every student to the limit of his potential. Our main criterion is acceptable and unacceptable utterances. We are bound to tolerate or accept a great variety of performance, if you like, to reflect the individual abilities of the learner. I think a useful slogan here would be defective but effective communication. There are already many misconceptions about the functional notional approach. It is not simply a utilitarian approach. It does not devalue grammar. It is not a method. What it is, first and foremost, is an approach to syllabus design and therefore in turn to course design, and it will be interesting to see how it is employed throughout this decade and where we will go next. I am conscious that this has been a rather superficial survey of the history of ELT since 1917. There have been many gaps and omissions, but any off-the-cuff attempt to survey such a long period is bound to be faulty. Nor does it help to be sitting alone and talking into a microphone. There really is no substitute for the stimulus of talking to someone or talking to a live audience. Even so, I hope I have covered some of the more important landmarks of this century. Thank you.